Every year, we return to three pillars, and they're right over there to your left, to my right. Worshipful, relational, missional. Those are our core values. We try to build a series around that because we all recognize the need to return often, deeply, to the things that matter the most. If we don't do that, we tend to lose sight of it. I know you've been there in your own lives. I know there I've been in mine where I'm either doing some things or I have some particular routines that maybe I've forgotten why I'm doing it. And we don't want to ever do that, not when it comes to the things of God, for sure. So we return to those things, and we will talk about it. We're just going to, next 5 weeks, including this one, kind of re-engaging the things that we value the most. This worshipful, relational, missional comes from Jesus himself. He says, love God, love others, love those that are still trying to find their way back to him. We want to be those things. Maybe we are to some extent, but we aspire to be even more deeply worshipful and missional and relational. One thing we don't always talk about when we return to this moment is vision. And I don't mean vision in sort of the branding, organizational, goal-setting type of way, but a picture of the future that we believe God is calling us toward, not only generally with the church at large, but even uniquely as a local entity. It's a sense of direction that we find not by me or a small group of people going to a mountaintop and receiving it, but that we do by listening prayerfully together as a community and collaborating. What is it and where is it that God wants us to be? We want to talk a little bit more about that this year than what we normally would. It's critically important. Some of you know Proverbs 29:18, and maybe you didn't know that you know it. You might be familiar with the phrase, where there is no vision, the people perish. More specifically, where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint. Where there is no revelation from God, when there is no picture about where he is leading, where he's pressing, where he's taking us, we tend to stop doing the disciplines and the things that we should do that form us into who he needs us to be and where he needs us to go. Where there is no vision, where there is no revelation from God, there is despair, there is something other than flourishing, and we cast off the very things that are important to be doing. So we want to keep vision in front of us as well. And I know that it's important for churches and organizations, but you can see it in your own life, like I've already suggested. When you lack clarity about where you're going or what you're doing, the sacrifices that you're making, the disciplines that you have engaged, you start to loosen on them. And you cheat. We cheat on the very things that are intended to be shaping us, and instead of flourishing, we deteriorate. So that's why it's good to have vision. Always have a vision for something bigger than you, something weighty that captures your heart and orients your choices, right? And we want to do those things as a church. We don't have it entirely worked out on purpose. It's a we thing. Where we are going, we need to be considering together and prayerfully forming the will that we understand God has for us, or understanding it, rather. Adam's going to jump in here for the last 10 or so minutes this morning. He's been thinking about a story, a metaphor that can come alongside what can sometimes be a principled organizational thing, a story that can help us connect with what it is that God's calling to us, maybe in ways we wouldn't normally be able to do it. But before we talk about where we're headed, I wanted to remind you of something that's true, something that's already true. You've been a good, good church. You have. I'm not being sentimental. I mean it. You've shown up for others. You've stayed through challenges, whether personal or interpersonal. You've shared what you have, often at real cost, and you've served and you've given quietly, faithfully, many of you for a very long time. You're a good church. You're a very good church. People know us. They trust us, even. When someone needs help, another church needs help, a group needs help, they think of you. They think of us. Trust is pretty hard to come by in this day and age. Churches don't automatically have credibility anymore. It's not an automatic thing. And yet, by God's grace, we have some. And it's not because we're flashy. It's not because we've chased trends. It's because you have kept choosing to be faithful in the small things. You're a good church. And it's worth pausing before we talk about anything else. God has done good things in you and through you. This church matters. I want you to let that register. If that's true, if God has been gracious to this church, and he has, if the faithfulness of you, the people of the church, have mattered, then there's a second truth that comes with that. Because faithfulness carries responsibility. Not responsibility out of obligation, responsibility because something has been entrusted. In Scripture, responsibility doesn't come through strength or confidence. God doesn't provide or give responsibility because the person receiving it is strong or courageous or confident. God places responsibility on the shoulders of the faithful. The faithful. When something grows, when something lasts, when it bears good fruit, it is able and expected to carry greater weight. Jesus says this again and again and again. You can find it in Matthew and Luke and John. In Matthew, the servant who's faithful with a little is given more to carry. In John 15, when Jesus is praying and talking about the branches, he says the branch that bears fruit is pruned so that it can bear more. In Luke, Jesus says it pretty plainly, from those who have been given much, much is required. In Scripture, responsibility is added to those who are faithful, which changes the question. This is pretty important. It changes the question from how do we sustain the good that is working? It changes the question from how do we sustain the good that's working to what does this good require from us now? Very different question. What does this good require of us now? What does the faithfulness, the trust, the things that God has blessed with us, the fruit that has bared, the good things, the good church that we've been, what does that mean for what's next? We don't think about that with anxiety. Maybe we do without, we don't check ourselves. It is with anticipation. God has entrusted, he's done something with us, he's put us in a beautiful place, not to just enjoy it and stay there, but think, well, okay, what do you want us to do with it? This is something I've seen bear out to be more true than I wish it was in my, 30-something years of being in church leadership. It's counterintuitive. One of the threats to a healthy church, one of the greatest threats to a healthy church is its stability. It's the strangest thing. When things are steady, when things are good, maybe even when the challenges are small, when you have enough of everything you need, it's easy to assume that staying put is what we should do. That's what's best. But where there is fruit, faith includes stewardship, not preservation. So before we get to vision and specifics and challenges, I want you to feel this moment. Faithfulness has brought us to a place. Your faithfulness. And the question in front of us now, to borrow from probably Aristotle, there's many different ways. Some of you remember Chuck Colson. He wrote a book called How Now Shall We Live? How will we live in response to what's been entrusted to us? The staff's been working on this vision and strategy, to use a technical term, the plan, the things that we feel we need to do to move us in the direction of what God has for us for a year or more. Talking together, praying, talking amongst you and leaders and folks in particular ministry areas, and our ears are wide open. The responsibility that we feel is upon us isn't narrow. It's not, well, let's focus on this one thing, or this one age group, or this one ministry area. When something's been entrusted, it tends to touch the whole life of the organization or the community. And we will go into this in greater depth. I want to give you six arenas that have risen to the surface of spaces we need to steward well. Some of you will feel like I'm not giving you enough on each one of those things, and each one of these will ultimately be their own message of sorts, their own deeply held reality that we'll talk through. But just briefly here, there are these six anchors in our vision. The first one is unity. We've begun to talk about this, and we've begun to practice some things that help us along as this. This is how we stay together, not just when things are easy, but when the tension shows up and opinions differ. This is a space where we test whether or not we scatter at the first sign of discomfort, or whether we stay long enough to listen and forgive and discern things together. Paul says that if you've tasted the real thing, the encouragement of Christ, the love of God, the fellowship of the Spirit, then it should lead to something other than the natural impulses of ambition and self-protection and positioning and posturing that ruin the church. He says, flood my heart with joy if you've experienced these things. Make our labor worth it, being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. This is the secret. As far as Paul was concerned, and surely as Jesus taught, the crowning jewel, the proof of a gospel-centered, gospel-believing church is unity among a diverse diversity, if I can say it that way. Unity, unity, unity. Family, right? As we prioritize family discipleship, especially our kids, not as projects, but as the future. So much of modern life is built to capture and shape our students and our children. We long to come together and help families with the rhythms and the boundaries and the relationships that will form young people in Jesus with clarity and courage and peace. Family, huge. The hub. We pooled our resources and our energies together to be in this space for other than just what we're doing right now. And it's already happening. We want to continue to press the hub as a missional tool for the city, an intersection where church and community can meet. A warm, well-lit place, as Adam likes to say, a place where counselors and entrepreneurs and students and neighbors share a space that hums with life and grace, a place where there's creativity and compassion and community, all in Jesus' name. The hub is a big part of what we hope to pursue well in the next 3 years. Unity, family, the hub. This very space right here, this worship space, how we gather, whether our time together actually reorients us around what is the most true and the most good, or whether it simply maintains a familiarity that we're comfortable with. We want our worship to form us, not just fit us. We want it to be something that works deeply in our own hearts, and not just our hearts, but those that are trying to find their way back to God. This space will continue to be very, very important. Mission. How we show up for people in need. Those that haven't found their way back to God. Alongside our Blessed 10 model, which some of you know about and some of you wonder what in the world that is. It's our relational pathway to eventually telling God's story to our friends and our own story within it. We want to continue to build a trusted support and referral network so that when we befriend someone, when you befriend someone, you have a place where you know they can be helped and you can be helped in helping them. The solution to the problems and the issues that you come alongside and other people aren't for you to handle alone. Rarely are they. We oftentimes feel that weight and sometimes keeps us from getting engaged because we think, No, we want to be a church that makes it possible, if not easy, for you to help somebody get the help that they need, to get the help that you need to help somebody. That's our mission, and we want to do well by that. Increasingly, across this community and this city and even Central Ohio, the dream in my own head is that when people come to a crisis, they come to a crossroads, they come to a difficulty, a challenge, they need help, someone's going to say to them, you should just check out Vista. They help people, no strings attached. That's a beautiful future. I hope we can make headway there. Unity, family, the hub, worship, mission, and this next one, every one of these is important by definition. We're making it an anchor. This one is non-negotiable. The next group of leaders. How we transfer leadership. Knowledge, relationships, and authority is critically important. Who is trusted? Who's invited in? How do we steward rather than guard our leadership or our authority places? Treating the next generation as actual partners to form and to entrust, not project managers to fill ministry roles. Paul encourages the young Timothy, he says, and the things you have heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful people who will be able to teach others also. The faith and the ownership of those who come next is the clearest indicator of where a church is headed. The faith and ownership of those who come next is the clearest indicator of where a church is headed. What ultimately shapes a deeply beautiful future church isn't only how faithful and good the current generation has been, but how faithfully the next generation lives and shapes the church they are entrusted with. It's a big one. So there's the six things, and we'll dig into these more. Each of these, if you think about it, fall under sort of a worshipful, relational, missional construct. And as we go through each one of those things in the coming weeks, we'll also talk about these things in greater depth. Are you with me? Unity. How important is that? Family, the hub, the worship, mission. Next generation, next leadership. So here's the big thing, go along with all that. We're kind of trying to introduce this phrase and get this bouncing around among us. We're building a church that will outlive us. I've said it this way in more casual settings. I would love for Vista to hit its peak 75 or 100 years from now. Not during my lifetime. Not during my leadership moment. Dozens of years from now, generations from now. Let's imagine a church that is climbing to its greatest peak way after we're gone. Gone. Not because the present doesn't matter. The present matters critically. But because faithfulness isn't measured by what we get to see completed. That's kind of the modern world we live in. You complete stuff. It's really measured by what we're willing to hand forward that's unfinished. That posture changes how we lead. It changes how we make decisions. It shifts the focus from protecting what's familiar to stewarding what's been entrusted. Forces us to think beyond attendance and momentum, more towards ownership and formation and durability. A church that outlives the current. It doesn't just invite younger people to show up. It prepares them to carry weight. It shares leadership early enough for judgment and character to be formed. It creates space for them to lead in visible, meaningful ways with older leaders close enough to guide, correct, and bless. That does not happen accidentally. The opposite happens accidentally. It happens when people choose to give away authority instead of guarding it. When they measure success not by how central we remain. There's significance issues the current generation always has to face. Yeah, but this is how I get my significance. If I hand it off, how do I find that? It measures rather than our capabilities, it says, how capable are others of becoming, right? So empowering the next generation isn't a side strategy. It can't be. It's one of the clearest expressions of faithfulness that we have. Okay, Adam's on his way up here. Last thing, there's always a cost. If you're going to do something that matters, it's going to move it from something that's to be talked about to owned. It's going to require something. It will test our patience. It will test our generosity. It requires time and energy and attention, especially toward people. It will call for humility when unity becomes uncomfortable. It will require courage to stay. All those sorts of things. Cost isn't a problem. It's the work. It is much of the work. Over time, participating, staying, they shape us into the kind of people God can trust us to carry his work forward and his story forward. We're living inside of a story, a big story, a monumental, eternal story. Ours is unique inside that story, but we're in that story nonetheless. And it's important to remember that. Because Adam and I were just talking this morning, faith and it's never just a set of like ideas and principles. It's lived inside something greater, bigger story, particular story. Yeah. You've been given some thought to that, right? I'm not popping this on you right now, right?
Well, I have been thinking about some things.
I've heard you
talk
about... I
tend to think about things.
You do?
Not always the right things.
Sometimes you and I just sit around thinking about stuff. We do.
Sometimes we let those thoughts come out.
Yes.
And talk about them.
But I've always loved the core of, I know the story you're sharing is this well-lit, warm place that comes around and around to you.
Yeah, it's a story that has impacted me, and it's a story that I dream of living into.
Yeah, me too.
A story I dream for us to live into.
Yeah.
As a body, as a family, as a community. And I do think story is the right next place to go. If you think about what separates us from all of creation is that we are storytelling beings. We are creatures that tell stories. Your brain requires that you tell stories. The data input that comes your way will be arranged by your brain into a story. And I believe that we have some freedom to choose which story to tell. And it's this interesting sort of relationship that Pastor Mike just set up that says, we're living within a grand story. What story will we tell? And the story that you believe you're living in, the one that you believe you're inhabiting, will influence the story that you choose to tell. There are all these data points. There's this setting that we are placed in. And the question becomes, what is this setting indicating about what story we live in? Here we are. We've been talking this morning about fresh beginnings. Alicia led us into this sense of this is a new beginning. We've reflected on the story that was told of 2025. What kind of story will be told in 2026? Takasha reminded us that Paul has us leaning into a story with rejoicing, a story that resounds and echoes off the walls of the setting and says, we will join in with the voice that says there's more beauty coming and there's more for us to give and more for us to be a part of. And Pastor Mike is putting bones and structure around this story that we hope to live into together. We hope because we believe that not only is there a setting of a story, there's an author. There's an author that has written hope into the story. But I do think it's interesting that we start here and now when it's 25 degrees outside and the sun may or may not come out for days on end. Because it's in that setting that we find our spirits reaching a bit of a tipping point. What kind of story is being drawn out? There are these storytellers around who are trying to tell us that this 25 degree winter day is really the way of things. That here we are in a setting that is dying very slowly, but it's just headed towards an end. This is indicative of what is coming, the cold, bleak winter. But here we are, a group of people whose story is very different than that, because we believe the setting is arranged by an author of love. And so we sing songs like In the Bleak Midwinter. And we remember in the middle of the bleak winter is when a story was resurrected, that life rebounded. Are we living in a setting where the earth is merely slowly dying, like some worldviews would like to tell us? Or are we living in a setting that is all of creation groaning, crying out, waiting for the daughters and the sons of God to be revealed, like it says in Romans 8. What we believe about the setting makes all the difference about what kind of story we believe we can tell in this life. And in the meantime, it would be good for us to remember that by story, we don't mean merely fiction. We have this way in the West of conflating the word story with the word fiction, and we have this false divide between stories that are nonfiction and stories that are fiction. Instead, we need to remember that the richness of the story that our author is telling is alive and well and being told with us as his characters to impress upon the world that, yes, January 1st is not a mere accident of the laws of nature, that the mid-bleak winter is not merely a sign of things to come, but actually instead is a fresh beginning. I actually think winter is the exact right time to remind ourselves of what the story really is that's being told. If you think about winter, it's actually quite beautiful. It's a kind of severe beauty, a kind of beauty that is sometimes hard to endure, like the sun just bouncing off of freshly fallen snow, and the way that you might have to shield your eyes from just how beautiful it is. There is this beauty all around us, and the question is this beauty a fleeting thing? Is this beauty of a sort of accident, a moment in time that's here and then gone? Or is it a sign of things to come? Is it a revelation of what is really, really real and what is truly true about our world? Is the freshly fallen snow and the white blanket and the beauty of, is that a fresh beginning? Or is it just teasing us? I believe very strongly that the setting is reminding us that there are true new beginnings. And there are things about winter that I think are actually worth considering and thinking about as a setting for our story. Winter is beautiful, but there's a way that it sort of requires an extra ounce of effort to enjoy. Have you ever dressed up your child to go out and play in the snow? So much effort. Those of you who grew up in places where they actually get real snow, you know, like, okay, I've got to invest in the gear, and once I have the gear, I've got to drive to the mountain, and once I do that, I've got to let the machine carry me to the top so I can slide back down. All of this wonder, it takes an extra ounce of effort. Yes, that's true. But in that, our setting reminds us that we are being shaped into those who will join God in shaping the future. This extra ounce of effort is actually what's good for us. Because if we're characters in a story, our story arc has to include us becoming who we were really meant to be. And I don't think we can become who we're truly meant to be with things simply being handed to us. There's something about that extra ounce of effort, that participation, that reminder that once upon a time we were planted in a garden to work it and to care for it. There's this way that setting doesn't just say like, oh, everything is just falling apart. And instead it's reminding us, no, we get to join in bringing about God's beautiful future that he hasn't intended for us, that he's made for us. But it's true, the beauty here that we experience in the winter time is a kind of fragile beauty, isn't it? It won't take long for the newest round of freshly fallen snow to turn into slush and gray. It's a kind of beauty that's crying out to be protected. It's a kind of beauty that's crying out for our ingenuity and imagination to be employed to expand it, to preserve it, to make it more and more of what people enjoy and experience in our world. And this winter and this beauty, like we have said in the setting, is a real challenge. For most of human history, winter was a real challenge. A real challenge that said, did you spend your 2025 well enough that 2026 is waiting for you? It's the kind of beauty and a severe beauty that sometimes reveals the choices you've made. Are we living in a world, are we living in a setting where there is a logic to the moments, the causes and effects? And are we living in a setting and in a story where there's a storyteller that will take every effect and leverage it for a beautiful cause? Yes, I believe we are. I believe we're living in a setting that not only reveals the folly of our past decisions, but those effects are used by the God of the universe to bring about wise creatures in the future. Ones that can join him in 2026, making for a 2027 where there's more beauty available to more people. Yeah, this will challenge us to live in the middle of this story that comes to this valley of a winter where it is stark sometimes. And there is this temptation to say, is there enough to get me to spring? And you can sort of sense it in your neighbors, a way of sort of closing in and saying, let me just preserve my own future. There's a temptation in the middle of this story to tip one direction or the other. Will we tip towards a story of scarcity that says, I will make sure that me and mine have enough for our future? Or will we open doors even wider, knowing that there are those in more need than ever? You see, as we enter into this story and the setting, the beauty of winter, imagine maybe leaning into the beauty, putting on just enough of an extra layer to engage it and head out into the cold. And imagine maybe going into the deep of the forest. There is a way that we get this sense that I needed to be maybe alone for just a minute to see how beautiful this was, and then I needed to be with others to be able to share that beauty, to express it more fully. There is this other side of the scarcity story that says, maybe I can lean into trust. I can lean into this sense that maybe actually sharing my story with others makes it ever more beautiful, ever more worthy of being lived into. There is this way that we can build a bigger cabin with larger windows and invite more people into the story rather than hunkering down and saying, at least I'm going to survive this winter. That's not a story beautiful enough to tell. But there is a story that is beautiful enough to tell. A story that's shared. A story that says this invigorating, life-giving, cold air is actually calling me into more life, more beauty, more of transcendent worth. So we want to tell a story. A story that not only can be shared with others, but others can share. They can be invited into. Imagine as life is like this winter season, there is a need for shelter, and you can see the ways that all human cultures for all of time have been building shelters for themselves. And some of them have much to recommend them. But we want to build a shelter, build a cabin that is so warm and well lit that people are drawn more deeply into the story, understanding that it's not merely an accident of nature that the snow fell and gave them this glimpse of a fresh start, but actually it's indicative of a future that is real, that there will be ultimately a fresh beginning experienced with others and because of the author. For us, we can lean into the trust side of the story and build a cabin that leverages the resources and is so warm and well lit that it invites more and more people in because we know that spring is coming. We know that there is signs of spring, even only internal to us, where the Spirit of God has inhabited us and said, yes, build another room. The Spirit of God has said, yes, actually dig deeper into your resources to fling the doors even more wide for the neighborhood around you. we aren't living in a cabin that's merely a shield from the elements, but rather a bridgehead of the spring that's coming. The warmth and the well-lit nature of the hub, to be honest, is not merely a shield from the difficulty of life, but it's a sign of the warmth of the spring sun that's coming. That's the story we want to live in. It's the story we want to inhabit. And this is a story we want to tell. So over the next few weeks, but actually also into the coming years, we want to think deeply together about what this story could look like. What is the most beautiful version of the story that God has for us? What is an author as beautiful as the Lord of the universe calling for his characters to be like? And I think when we do that, we'll realize that building on Christ, building in Christ, is the most beautiful story that can be told. And it's a story that is inexhaustible, in that there's always more room for others. There's always more warmth to be shared, and there's always a seat by the fire in the story that God is telling. So we want to lean into the story that says, I believe spring is coming. I believe that spring has actually taken root in my own heart and intends to grow outwards for others always, all the time. We want to build that story on the greatest storyteller, the one who told the story that's truly true and really real about a resurrection and a spring that's coming in Jesus. We want to build our lives on that story and then live it out.